I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, sporadic clashes reported at revolution anniversary rallies in Egypt. Concerned security steps in a post-Benghazi raid era may make the job harder. The Israeli election could impact the Obama-Netanyahu relationship. And is Turkey aiding Iran through the gold trade? It's all ahead. Egyptians are marking the anniversary of their uprising 2 years ago, with crowds pouring again into Cairo's Tahrir Square and rallies in dozens of major towns in what many say is a continuation of the revolution that brought down longtime leader Hosni Mubarak. Sporadic clashes were reported with police using tear gas in Alexandria to disperse protesters. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
Early morning clashes between protesters and police in Cairo gave way to prayers and rallies later in the day. The mood was less joyous than 2 years ago, when Egyptians seemed to surprise even themselves with a show of popular power against an entrenched leadership. Protesters who've taken to the square on countless occasions in the intervening time spoke with resignation of the struggle that continues.
We are here in 25 January not to celebrate, not to support any party, any movement, but to resume our uncompleted revolution.
The views of this young protester, Zane, were seconded by an elderly man who came from Aswan in the south to join in the rally. Mokhtar says his country has merely replaced one uncaring leader with another.
Where is the democratic? We are changing. Mohammed Hosni Mubarak, Mohammed Morsi only. We don't have anything correct from Mohammed Morsi since 8 months.
But even as the crowds gathered around the tents and banners that have made Tahrir the continued center of unrest, the leader of President Morsi's political party spoke of what had been accomplished in the past 2 years. Hussein Ibrahim, head of the Freedom and Justice Party, said Egypt marks the second anniversary with two achievements of immense importance, an elected civilian president and a constitution approved by the Egyptian people. The controversial constitution was adopted in a referendum late last year after Mr. Morsi assumed temporary sweeping powers. His decree sparked violent clashes between the opposition and the government's Islamist supporters. The president still has a loyal following among the Brotherhood, the nation's best organized movement. Leaders called for charity work rather than street rallies Friday, a decision that appeared aimed at lowering the potential for clashes. The divisions are not just between those two groups. There are also those who look nostalgically at life before the revolution, when stability, if not vibrancy, was for many a given. But Friday was a day for the people of Tahrir and their counterparts across the country. Everywhere were signs celebrating the revolutionary youth and announcing the aging leadership of the Brotherhood. One protester, Mohammed Ibrahim Garib, says the generational divide is a problem not just in Egypt, but across the Arab world.
We are the future, so enough with the old people.
But the generation that fueled the uprising has yet to coalesce into a strong political force. Whether they can change that before the next milestone in Egypt's transition, upcoming parliamentary elections, remains far from certain. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Officials from Britain, Germany, and the Netherlands have urged their citizens to immediately leave the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi, following what has been described as a specific and imminent threat against Westerners. Foreign ministries of the three countries issued statements about the security situation in Benghazi. Britain says there was a high threat of terrorism in the city, adding that attacks could be indiscriminate and target places frequented by foreigners. It is not clear how many people will be affected by the advisories. The warnings come a day after U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testified before Congress on the September 11th attack on the U.S. compound in Benghazi, which killed U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans. The secretary said the raid prompted her to take several urgent steps to improve security at diplomatic posts worldwide. But some American diplomats say they worry that new security rules ordered by Washington also could make it harder for their counterparts to do their jobs. Ronald Newman is a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Algeria, and Bahrain. He tells VOA's Michael Lippin that political pressure on the Obama administration to avoid risky diplomacy is now more severe.
what has changed is the political pressure in Washington against risk, which is even more severe than it was before Benghazi. And that is, I think, one of the biggest problems we're dealing with is an environment that is now so risk-adverse that it risks making our job or the job of diplomats harder, much harder to do.
Well, I've heard that security measures already are quite tight at U.S. missions overseas. I'm wondering if that heightened sense of risk or aversion to risk has actually translated into even stricter measures in any parts of the world.
I think it has, but you would have to look at a case-by-case basis. It is mostly a question of what movements outside embassies people are willing to do, whether they're taking out family members. For instance, Algeria just went on what's called authorized departure, which means people who are not comfortable can leave. Also freezes people who might have been out of the country on leave or travel and can't get back in. So, you know, there's a very specific sort of large action. In many posts, it'll be smaller actions, looking at size of staffing, where people live, all these things.
Secretary Clinton has talked about several steps that she has taken since the Benghazi attack to address security. She's talked about working with the Pentagon to send hundreds of Marine security guards to various missions. She's talked about also appointing a new State Department official to oversee that process. What is your assessment of those steps that she has announced so far?
I think they're good steps. They're useful. They're doing what they can. She's also pointing out to the Congress that there is money that they have, which they need to devote to this, but the Congress has to approve them moving it from one budget to another, and the Congress has not done so. So there are steps that the Congress has to take as well. I do think that there is no perfect security, and there never will be. So, yes, the steps are good. They're useful. They're necessary. They do not mean you cannot have another Benghazi or another diplomat killed. That is not within the realm of the possible.
That was Ronald Newman we were listening to. He is a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Algeria, and Bahrain, now president of the nonprofit group, the American Academy for Diplomacy. Banks in Turkey continue to send gold to Iran despite U.S. pressure to curb a booming gold for gas trade, which helps Iran skirt international sanctions. Dorian Jones takes a look at the flow of gold from Ankara to Iran.
This month, Turkish customs grounded a Turkish cargo plane en route from Ghana to Iran that was reportedly carrying a ton and a half of gold. In the last year, Tehran has been accumulating huge amounts of the precious metal as a means of circumventing ever-tightening international financial sanctions over its nuclear enrichment program, which some nations fear is being used to develop a nuclear weapons capability. Attila Yeşilada of the Istanbul-based research firm Global Source Partners says Turkey continues to provide the lion's share of Tehran's demand for gold.
Gold sales to Iran have been diversified through Switzerland and Abu Dhabi, I believe, but they continue. The annualized total is something like $11 billion, most of it financed through the gold stock of Turkish people. This gold has become Iran's main currency in terms of securing necessities.
Last November, Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister Ali Babacan confirmed that Tehran pays for gold from Turkish lira payments it receives for its gas exports to Turkey. Iran sells 90% of its natural gas to Turkey, making it Ankara's second largest supplier after Russia. To stem the flow of gold, U.S. President Barack Obama this month signed into law a ban on the sale of precious metals to Iran. But Turkish Foreign Ministry spokesman Selçuk Unal says Turkey is not bound by the measure.
Turkey only feels itself only legally bound only by the UN Security Council resolutions or sanctions adopted under Chapter 7.
However, analyst Yeşilada says he expects Ankara to eventually comply.
The United States would first try to convince Ankara to unilaterally stop these, and if that's not working, we will see rising pressure that paralyzes those who in any way intermediate or help intermediate this trade.
Until now, Ankara has largely complied with US measures against Tehran, but Ankara still has to pay its bill for Iranian gas. Analysts point out that diversifying Turkey's energy dependency on Iran takes time and can be expensive. This month, Turkey signed a $12 billion deal with an Abu Dhabi company to develop the use of coal in energy production. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
Middle East analysts say the results of this week's Israeli elections could set the stage for an improved relationship with Washington and impact the future of peace talks with the Palestinians in efforts to curb Iran's nuclear program. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell reports for VOA Television from Washington.
Yair Lapid is the new star of Israeli politics. The 49-year-old former television host burst onto the political scene with his centrist party capturing second place in parliamentary elections and positioning himself as a power broker in the formation of the next government. Analysts say the vote was a rebuke to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. His conservative ticket lost seats in the new parliament despite placing first.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
The Israeli vote came as U.S. President Barack Obama was inaugurated for a second term. Analysts say his leadership style is bolder since his re-election. Robert Satloff is executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
It is absolutely true that Netanyahu's success was not as great as Obama's success, but it's a different political environment.
President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu have had a rocky relationship, but that could improve if Mr. Netanyahu forms a government open to talks with the Palestinians. Jerusalem-based analyst David Ricci.
It won't be a moderate government, but it will be compelled, I think, by international pressure to reopen negotiations. I think the President of the United States is very interested in that.
After Mr. Obama's inauguration, White House spokesman Jay Carney repeated the president's policy.
What needs to take place is direct negotiations between the two parties that address the final status issues and that result in a two-state solution.
But some Palestinians in the West Bank are skeptical that a new Israeli government will be a positive development. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki.
While the Palestinian leadership has reaffirmed its immediate readiness to engage in negotiations on the basis of clear parameters, Israel, however, has instead persisted in its path of occupation, conflict, and fear-mongering.
If there is a centrist government, Mr. Netanyahu may be under less pressure for a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. The Obama administration is hoping a combination of sanctions and diplomacy will avert an armed confrontation. Again, Robert Satloff.
The Israelis are willing to let the United States play this out, play Obama's strategy out to the very end, and see whether the Obama strategy succeeds in convincing Iran to negotiate an end to its military nuclear program.
It's likely to take weeks to form a new coalition government, and Yair Lapid is expected to be right in the middle of the negotiations. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
As Barack Obama was inaugurated, there was a wide range of expectations for the president's second term in the White House regarding U.S. Middle East policies. VOA Middle East senior correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed the issue with several experts, and we asked about the major themes he found.
First, of course, was the handling of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, then the U.S. policy or lack of toward the Arab Spring, and lastly, the recommendations on Syria and Iran policies.
Let us start then with the U.S. policy toward the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Well, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu managed to win a third term, some experts say chances that the U.S. will actively push for a renewed Israeli-Palestinian peace talks seem dim. David Pollack, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, said the U.S. should state in public that it's still supporting the two-state solution as the only alternative to the long-standing conflict and he said the U.S. should ask both Israelis and Palestinians to reiterate their public commitment to the principle of a permanent, peaceful two-state solution to their conflict. However, David Pollack advised against U.S. offering a package for a permanent solution in the second term.
Parties aren't in the mood for it. They're too far apart on substance, and they're even further apart on sentiment, on the level of trust or distrust and the belief or disbelief that peace is really possible on both sides, both in the governments and among their publics, right, on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians. So I don't think that a package peace plan is realistic, unfortunately, right now. I think it would be a mistake, and I think that the American government probably understands that it would be worse to propose something that is doomed, or probably doomed, to fail.
That was David Pollack, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
But Marwan Maasher, the Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, disagreed with Pollack and said the choice now for the Obama administration is between the difficulty of achieving peace today and the impossibility of achieving it tomorrow. He argued that the U.S. must commit itself to work through the quartet to bring about a speedy settlement of the conflict and put a package on the negotiating table before it's too late. Maasher said making peace in the Middle East in Obama's second term is vital not only to the U.S. national interest but also for the Palestinians and the long-term future of Israel and stability of the entire region.
Well, what about U.S. policy toward the Arab Spring?
Well, that's another challenge facing the Obama administration in the second term, how to formulate a concrete strategy to deal with the sweeping changes in the Middle East, known now as the Arab Spring. Marwan Maasher finds it's impractical to try one-size-fits-all policy because every Arab country has its own set of interests related to the U.S. He cited a different U.S. response in Libya than in Bahrain because U.S. policy depends not only on values but also on interests, and said,
I don't think there is a unified policy. I don't think that Americans have a conspiracy to bring in Islamists to power. I don't subscribe to all that. What I do think is happening is that the United States is learning how to deal with a changing region and to accept the result of elections and to deal pragmatically with it, insist on democratic norms, but not shun away results of peaceful elections.
Maasher said the U.S. should focus on institutions, not individuals, and avoid imposing political conditionality on aid, trade, or other support, because such attempts now within the Arab Spring atmosphere is likely to provoke a strong nationalistic reaction. David Pollack, however, disagreed and said the U.S. should try as hard as it could to maintain its close ties with Egypt, for example, tying its support, whether politically or economically, to certain requests like a continued Egyptian adherence to the peace treaty with Israel. Chas Freeman, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, pointed out to the fact that with the Arab Spring, Arab governments have learned the hard way that they must defer to public opinion, which is becoming increasingly Islamist. He said America's interest in the Middle East now demands fundamental rethinking, not just of U.S. policies, but also of strategic objectives those policies should be designed to achieve.
Mohammed, what is the Middle East expert's vision of what U.S. policies should be toward Iran and Syria?
William Quant, a professor at the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia and a former member of the National Security Council, is calling for a U.S. diplomatic rapprochement to overcome the long U.S.-Iran estrangement. He said the new Secretary of State should find a reliable channel to Iran's top leadership and start his own assessment of how to forge a new relationship with Iran. Quant argued that the deal on nuclear capabilities of Iran needs to be a part of a larger package. If that succeeded, he said, the benefits would be seen in places such as Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and the Gulf region. On the other hand, Quant expected Syria to be a serious challenge to its policies in the Middle East because the Assad regime cannot restore its power and the Syrian opposition is not poised for a clear-cut early victory. David Pollack described, however, the civil war in Syria as a tragic example of the Arab Spring gone terribly wrong because of Assad's stubbornness. However, he did not see much sign that the U.S. policy will change toward the Syrian civil war in Obama's second term and expected U.S. policy to continue to be extremely cautious. But he hoped that the administration will realize that the situation in Syria demands a more U.S. active role because, he said, risks are enormous for the entire region.
Well, thank you very much, Mohammed. That's very insightful.
Thank you.
That's VOA Middle East Senior Correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawy right here in our Washington studios. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.